From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This is our critical week for Democrats, with deadlines piling up on plans that will affect millions of Americans, as well as the party's own political future. President Biden's huge social safety net plan, the 10-year, over $3 trillion budget plan, is very much up in the air right now, because while there are enough Democrats to pass it in the House, moderate Democrats say they won't do that unless there are enough votes on the smaller infrastructure bill, which needs Republican support and had some in the crafting of the bill. The House vote has been pushed back from today to Thursday, when there's the threat of a government shutdown over raising the debt ceiling. We need a whiteboard. Let's bring in Jamal Simmons, Here and Now's Democratic political strategist. Jamal, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell says this is a week from hell. Do you agree? And what in your mind is at stake?
You know, it does sound like it's going to be a tough week for the president and for Democrats. But, you know, it's a tough world out there. So, listen, I think what's at stake right now is getting the president's, both the bipartisan infrastructure plan passed, as well as this reconciliation package, so that the president is making a real concrete dent in the lives of American public, so they know they're going to get something out of the Biden administration. The $1.9 trillion plan the president passed when he first took office for COVID, I think, was a great step. It did a lot of positive things. But if the Democrats can't figure out how to pass something like this when they've got control of all three branches of government, even more slimly, it's going to make a very tough argument to take to the voters next year.
Well, did President Biden make a misstep? Some say he did. Agreeing to split off infrastructure into the separate compromise bill with Republicans, was that a mistake?
I don't think it was a mistake. I think, you know, these things are never pretty, and you can always look back and say, what if? But you've got to make real-time game decisions. I think the president knew that they needed to get something done. They could get Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema on board with the bipartisan deal. Let's get that done. And then he wants to go back and get this reconciliation package done. Now, what I'm understanding is today at 5:30 is going to be a big day, right? It's going to be 5:30 today is a big time, because the House caucus is going in to have a conversation, moderates and progressives together, about what to do going forward. Nancy Pelosi has called that meeting. And at 5:30 on the Senate side, there's going to be a vote on the continuing resolution to keep the government funded and perhaps pass the debt limit, which Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, is saying he's going to tank that vote if the debt limit is included in that, because Republicans don't want to be responsible for paying the bills for the tax cuts that they did under the Trump administration.
Okay, so people tune into All Things Considered, see how that goes. But meanwhile, House Speaker Pelosi, you know, she wants to pass this 3.5, 10-year, people leave that out, spending plan. But you know, there are a bunch of different committees that put it together. The price tag ballooned. She's now signaling it may be shaved down. Now you have not just the Republicans, but the Democrats on the left who are angry about that. Is there anything Democrats should be willing to give up?
Listen, they're going to cut a deal, and it's going to probably be a smaller financial commitment. The number is going to be smaller. But I think the progressives are asking a very fair question, which is, it's not just about the numbers, it's also about the programs. And what is it that the moderates want to cut? Do they want to cut the transition to electric vehicles? Do they want to cut healthcare coverage or pre-K, community college? What is it they want to cut? Then they can have a conversation. My understanding from talking to progressive member of Congress end of last week, is that they're also looking for, the progressives are looking for, some show of good faith from the moderates, some understanding that we're all in this together and they're going to actually vote for the second part of the deal. That's the key to unlocking progressives' votes for the bipartisan deal that has already been negotiated in the Senate.
Well, and how much does it matter, you know, to people that something, the Democrats have to come out with something? I mean, isn't there a sense of, hey, we need to just cut something here to show that we did something, whereas the, you know, Republicans just folded their arms?
Yeah, the alternative is really bleak. Right. I mean, if they don't pass something.
And polls show people want something.
They do. And the danger is, you know, there's a thing in politics sometimes, there's physics and then there's metaphysics. And what the other thing that Democrats have to be worried about is that this deal doesn't get any stink on it. right? So that people just feel like even if it passes, they think it's a bad plan because everything, yeah. the mechanics of getting it done were so bad and so foul.
Yeah.
So they've got to get it done and get it done quickly.
Jamal Simmons, Here Now political strategist, The Democrat. Thanks.
Thank you.
An electric car company linked to China's Evergrande is having trouble paying its suppliers and will no longer sell new shares on the Shanghai Stock Exchange. This comes as Evergrande's main real estate business is tanking. The company failed to make an $84 million interest payment last week and could soon default on its more than $300 billion in debt. And let's bring in NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Fang with more. Welcome back.
Hey, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
The Evergrande Group has been trying to sell part of its stake in the electric car company to help pay off some of its debt. How do the electric car makers' financial issues mirror Evergrande as a whole?
The issues that they're having stem completely from the group's larger financial deficits. And the problem with the car company in particular is that they don't have as many working prototypes as they had hoped. So there's not much working product to show that this is a valuable company and then to sell that to another electronic car maker. Meanwhile, you're also buying into the risks of the bigger group. And those risks are that they have, as you mentioned, more than $300 billion in liabilities and overall debts. They still have a bunch of bond interest payments that they're scheduled to make. They are set to default in at least one of them. And so it's unclear how Evergrande is going to be wrapped up. It's almost certain that it will be allowed to go bankrupt. But the question is, what happens to the people Evergrande owes?
Right. Now wealthy investors and others who put their money into Evergrande are demanding their money back. What are the potential ripple effects here?
One thing is the investors who put money into Evergrande are not always wealthy. These are often retail investors, so just regular individuals who may have bought financial products or bought shares in Evergrande or bought apartments that Evergrande was selling, and now Evergrande has no money to finish building those units. So these are average people, for the most part, who are now asking for their money back. And a big chunk of the debt that Evergrande owes is not just to banks, but it's to other companies. So these are construction companies and contractors. These are people who provided building materials. And they're now facing bankruptcy and cannot pay their workers because they're owed, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars by Evergrande.
There have been protests in China, right, from people affected by the company's crisis, by suppliers, investors, and basically people who bought homes. How is the government handling this?
They've been trying to negotiate on behalf of these investors. Local governments have dispatched officials who are directly working with local Evergrande subsidiaries to, one, make sure that people get their money back if they invested money, and two, if people bought houses already, that those units are then built in the future, even if that means another developer has to step in and take on that project. Home buyers, many of whom I've interviewed, are astonishingly optimistic because in the past, given the Chinese state's wariness about protests, usually when there is some uncertainty about a developer going belly up, the government will step in, will bail them out, and will make sure those houses are built. So there's that moral hazard expectation that's built into the Evergrande crisis. But this time, I think, will be a little bit different. I think the government will let Evergrande default. The question is how smooth that default will be and how wide the ripple effects will travel.
Right. Some experts have expressed concern that Evergrande's financial issues could result in major consequences for the global markets, not unlike what happened with the Lehman Brothers when they filed for bankruptcy back in 2008. How quickly could something like that happen?
Chinese regulators and policymakers are very, very aware of Evergrande, and they're very conscious that Evergrande could lead to depressed property sales that could then lead other developers to default. So they will be stepping in the next few weeks to tamp down those fears. They likely will press state-owned companies to buy off some of Evergrande's assets and unfinished projects, and they'll likely pressure state-owned banks to hoover up some of that bad debt that Evergrande cannot pay back. So things are going to hurt. China's working with a much slower economy, lower retail sales, property sales that were already dipping because of the COVID epidemic even before Evergrande. But they are going to make sure that the pain doesn't pass through the rest of the Chinese economy. That being said, they want Evergrande to serve as an example to other developers. This is the end of debt-fueled infrastructure building that has stimulated the Chinese economy for the last two decades.
Emily, before we let you go, over the weekend, China, Canada, and the United States completed this prisoner swap that sent an executive for Chinese tech giant Huawei back to China in return for a Canadian diplomat and entrepreneur. What do we know about that exchange?
The Chinese executive you mentioned, Meng Wanzhou, landed back in China Saturday night in China time. To immense fanfare, Huawei and the local government arranged a delegation to meet her. She gave a speech on the tarmac in which she was fighting back tears and she thanked the Chinese Communist Party and the motherland for caring for her and bringing her back. And she's become this nationalist hero. So you've seen this really amazing divergence in how the two countries are perceiving the same issue. In China, this is an example of China standing up to U.S. bullying. And in Canada and the U.S. and other countries that are American allies, I think this case is being seen with a lot of moral disgust that somehow hostage diplomacy is now the de facto tactic China uses to bring back its citizens.
That's NPR Beijing correspondent Emily Fang. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Composer William Goldstein has written dozens of scores for film and television, but he now specializes in instant compositions, music made in the moment, something he was so good at, Columbia professors wanted to meet him at the age of 9. Well, he's just released a new album of instant composition collaborations with other musicians, including Grammy-winning guitarist Lawrence Tuber and violinist Lily Hayden. This is a little of their Vilna. William Goldstein's new album is called Collaborative Composition. He joins us now. Welcome.
Wonderful to be with you, Robin.
This has been going on for a long time, this idea of instant compositions.
Well, it was all the rage in the 18th and 19th centuries. Anybody who saw Amadeus saw Mozart sit down at a piano and just wow the kings and queens and princesses. Chopin wrote impromptus, and Franz Liszt used to do the three-note thing. He'd have people write three notes on a piece of paper, put them in a hat, and pass it to the stage. He'd pick out a piece of paper, and he'd create a piece based on the three notes. Mm. And it kind of just disappeared. Actually, I never thought much about it, and I had no idea that my ability to sit and create things in real time were of interest to anybody. And I thought this was something that, you know, all composers could do effortlessly. And it was only in Poland in 2011 at the Transatlantic Festival where I discovered that it was not common amongst my colleagues. It was a wake-up call for me, and it kind of changed my life.
Yeah, no kidding. You now even have a competition. You headed up a jury of people doing this three-note instant composition. I tell you what, let's try it right now. We know you have a piano there.
Yes.
I'll supply, right? Is this what we're going to do? I'll supply the three notes?
Yes, but what I'd really love you to do, Robin, yeah, is to supply three notes that kind of resonate with you.
Oh.
So if you want to sing three notes, or sometimes people give me really odd notes, you know, like to just, you know, what can you do with that? So you can always do something.
Okay.
But it's best if it's something that relates to you.
All right. Well, I think B flat is the most beautiful note. Right? So, down, 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 that's a B-flat. D, F, B-flat. D, F, B-flat. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Wonderful. All right.
There's a Copland piece that opens like da, da, da. I mean, it's got that feel to me.
Well, I love Copland, and if you're a Copland fan, let's see if a little Copland influence doesn't sneak in here. So I'm going to put the phone down for a second.
Sure.
And
instant composition from William Goldstein.
Thank you.
so cool.
That's a bit shorter than I usually do them, but is a radio broadcast.
Well, you know, right? You got my heart. That was like, that's my song.
It is.
Do people feel that way? Like, those are my notes.
Yes. And there are a number of YouTube videos on my YouTube channel. There's one, Annika, The Nobility of the Human Spirit. There's another one called Carla Picks Three Notes. Small audiences. I've done these in my home, and everybody is very emotional. Not only the person who picks the three notes, but you can look around, and the responses are very humbling to me. I don't really understand really what's going on, but it's pretty amazing.
A piece that William Goldstein created for Carla from her three notes, but he also just created one for me. Okay, I gotta ask you. Have you played that for other people? I mean, are there tricks here?
That's the whole idea of the three notes. You give me three notes because I don't know what you're going to give me, and therefore these pieces are always different.
I understand you started doing this when you were 3 or 4 years old.
Well, that's when I went to the piano and started picking out notes. I never had a formal education. I grew up in a non-musical family, no piano in the home, but my dad was in the hotel business. And during the summer, we lived in the summer hotel in Belmar, New Jersey, and there was a piano in the ballroom. And little Billy used to go over there and start picking out stuff. And by the time I was 8, I'd go to the movies and come back and play things that I'd heard, which is how I ended up at Teachers College, Columbia University, when I was 9. Being interviewed by a wonderful man named Raymond Burroughs, gave my mother all kinds of advice, none of which she took.
Well, 9 years old at Columbia. But on your new album, let's fast forward. You're not playing those three notes thrown out by an audience. You're collaborating with other musicians. Let's listen to a little. This is Lawrence Juber, lead guitar for Paul McCartney in the band Wings. They won a Grammy together. Let's listen to a little of your Point and Counterpoint. Goldstein, this isn't scripted. You're not looking, you know, at notes. But how is this different that you're playing off each other than, let's say, jazz?
Oh, it's very different. With jazz, you start with an existing composition upon which you improvise, or at least there are chord changes. There's some roadmap. But when I'm doing instant composition or when I'm doing collaborative composition, is starting with nothing and building a structure. We're starting from scratch, so jazz never starts from scratch. If it does, it's very free form. To my knowledge, I don't know anybody who's been improvising free form jazz that actually has the elements of composition, which are developed motifs and what you would recognize. But what's interesting here is I didn't think collaborative composition was possible at all until a really good friend of mine, Jim DePasquale, who was on the album, came to me after I did my first couple of solo piano improvised composition albums and said, hey, we should try this together. And I said, try this together? It's not possible. How's anybody going to follow me? I don't know where I'm going when I'm doing this. I'm sort of in a zone and I don't want to be distracted. And he said, well, let's try it. We did, and it was rough going at first, but then magic started happening. Somehow I'm able to spin out structures. As in jazz, they hear a motif and they repeat it, or they come up with a melodic line themselves that I repeat. And essentially we're having a simultaneous dialogue.
Yeah. So that's the collaborative composition. Back to the, you know, just the instant composition.
Yes.
The three notes. What's the strangest notes you've gotten?
Well, there's something that was filmed in Krakow, Poland, a three-note challenge. A gentleman who won a contest, he picked three really ridiculous notes. I think it was something like, you know, and what are you going to do with that? Very, very, very unpleasant.
That was tough, but you took the challenge. William Goldstein, doing instant compositions. People throw out three notes. He comes up with a song, and his new album is Collaborative Composition, doing the same kind of just building a song as it goes with well-known musicians. We'll link you up to all these YouTube videos at hearnow.org. Bill, William Goldstein, thank you so much.
Robin, thank you so much. Real pleasure.
And I can't believe I cried when I heard this. My three notes. It's here now. So colleges are bringing students back to campus for in-person instruction. Families are looking for ways to pay for that. And the free application for federal student aid, it's known as FAFSA, opens this Friday. But there are a few things that can be done today to prepare. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, host of Jill on Money. And Jill, I know that there are people breaking out in hives just hearing this word, because historically this application has been very complicated. You say start as soon as possible. Tell us more.
Well, first of all, I do want to mention, you're right. It used to be a bear of an application. It's a lot easier now, mostly because the IRS website and the Department of Education website now speak to each other. Imagine that. Mm. So you will not have to worry, especially if you've completed electronic filing for the IRS. So that's a lot easier. The main thing to understand is, although the deadline is not until next spring, a lot of schools in this country award their financial aid based on a first-come, first-served basis. So that means when this becomes available on October 1st, later this week, it is incumbent on families to get cracking, because there are thousands of dollars here that really could be in your student's bottom line and not someone else's.
So for people new to this, or, you know, maybe looking at it a couple years down the road, we know that just 68% of families with college students filled out the FAFSA last year. Obviously, there was a pandemic. But some would say, well, wait a second, who gets to fill it out? I mean, do you fill it out even if you are of means? How does it work?
Obviously, if you make $1 million a year, you're not getting financial aid.
Okay.
But there are a lot of people who erroneously believe they will not qualify, and they blow off completing the FAFSA form. And these are the folks I'm really worried about. I hear from them all the time. There are a lot of families, depending on your specific circumstance, that it's not just based on income. It's what else is going on in your financial life. So probably if you make more than $300,000, you're not going to do it. But if you're in that range where you say, oh, I make low six figures, I won't get it, just do it anyway. The other aspect of this, really important, is that your circumstances can change, and it's a lot easier to update a FAFSA than to start from fresh.
Well, okay, so people who want to participate, what do they need to do before Friday when the applications open?
I think the best thing that you can do is to familiarize yourself with the FAFSA website, which is studentaid.gov, and start looking at the FAFSA form. And what you also should do is maybe familiarize yourself with how aid is determined. And I think this is, again, part of this idea that the cost of attendance of a university or a college is very different. So too is your expected family contribution. There is also one other thing I should always say, and that is that you're going to get this big letter back, and it's going to say, here is a grant, here is aid, here is this, here's that. And be careful to understand the terms. You want to differentiate between free money, a grant, or a loan, right, or work study. That's the most important thing you can do, is familiarize yourself with a lot of these terms. They sometimes get conflated and people don't understand that they're on the hook for loans when they think it was just free money.
A grant you don't have to pay back, a loan you do. Work study means you have to work.
Yeah, be familiar with that.
Yeah. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Afghanistan is plunging further into an economic crisis. Prices for basic goods have soared since the Taliban overthrew the Afghan government, and the U.S. and other Western nations have also frozen more than $9 billion in assets and stopped most international aid, contributing to a cash crunch that is making daily life difficult for most Afghans. Suni Rasmussen is a correspondent with the Wall Street Journal and joins us now from Kabul. Welcome. And first, just how bad is the economic situation in Afghanistan right now?
Well, the Afghan economy is on the verge of collapse, I think. It has been many years where the U.S. has tried to build a sustainable economy in Afghanistan, and we see now the extent to which that has been a failure. Afghanistan has always been a poor country. After Western countries pulled out or withdrew most of their aid from the country, the economy sort of had to stand on its own two feet. But then at the same time, Afghanistan has also been slapped with sanctions because the Taliban have taken control of the country. So that means that Afghanistan's foreign reserves have now been frozen. The currency is stable for now, but there's a real risk that it might plummet dramatically. The unemployment has been very high for many years. It's been somewhere between 25% and 30%. And that has only soared further after the Taliban took control of the country, because a lot of government officials left their jobs and haven't been invited back. And a lot of young professionals left the country simply because they fled Taliban rule. So there's a lot of things at play. All in all, it's a very dire situation that could get much worse very quickly.
And you travel to the south, where the situation is pretty dire.
Yeah, I spent the past week in Zabul and Kandahar and Helmand provinces. And this is one of the most impoverished regions of the country. People in the south are really feeling the brunt of the economic crisis at the moment, whether that's an inability to buy enough food for your family. But at the same time, Afghanistan is plagued by a pretty serious drought. And that means that people in the south are migrating to other areas. Rivers that used to have a lot of water have run completely dry. Irrigation is failing. So it's a lot of calamities coming together all at once for the people of the south. I think they're facing a very serious winter to come.
Has the Taliban responded to this situation? Have they put forward a plan for the economy since taking over?
They haven't put forward a plan for how to salvage the economy, but they have responded to the pressure. The main line we hear from the Taliban in Afghanistan now is that the U.S. must unfreeze its funds and must lift sanctions on Afghanistan, and it must do so to avoid a humanitarian crisis. The line from the Taliban, but also from many Afghans, former officials and current officials, is that these roughly $9-10 billion that are held abroad are not the Taliban's money. It's money that belongs to the Afghan people. And that's also what the Taliban is saying. So that has been a response so far.
You spoke to a former Central Bank board member and several former finance ministers from Afghanistan about this issue, specifically of frozen assets. And they have differing views on this issue. What are they saying?
Yeah, that's right. In the Central Bank, or the board member that I've spoken to, Shah Merabi, he makes the argument that the money that is frozen abroad does not belong to the Taliban government. It belongs to the Afghan people. Therefore, the U.S. should unfreeze Afghan funds. They should do so in limited batches of money. They should do so in a monitored way so they can check what the money is actually being spent for and not being spent on, for example, terrorism, if that's what the U.S. fears, or other things that could prop up the Taliban. The counter-argument to that, which other former Afghan officials make, is that the frozen funds and sanctions are the only tool of pressure that the U.S. has left against the Taliban. So if the U.S. wants to in any way influence the political situation here, the human rights situation, if they want to try and push the Taliban to form a more inclusive government, well, then they have to maintain this economic leverage against the Taliban.
In the more immediate, I mean, if these assets stay frozen, is international aid enough to keep the economy afloat?
No. In general, international aid goes to projects in Afghanistan. It goes to, for example, healthcare projects, schools. It could also go to food aid and things like that in the provinces. But the big problem for Afghanistan is that they don't have enough reserves of foreign cash. And foreign aid is not going to help that. Afghanistan's problem is also that it's very import dependent. It doesn't really have an industry. The main goods that Afghanistan exported back in 2001 were dried fruit and opium. And that's the case today as well. It doesn't have an industry to speak of. So that means that Afghanistan is completely dependent on imports from other countries. And if it doesn't have foreign cash reserves, it can't import enough food and other goods to sustain its people. Foreign aid is not going to solve that problem. It can maybe help alleviate the suffering in the short term, but it's not going to solve Afghanistan's economic problems.
That's Suni Rasmussen, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, speaking with us from Kabul. Thank you.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
In the state of Florida over the last 2 years, the medical marijuana market has more than doubled with more than 600,000 registered patients. And on the business level, state law requires medical marijuana growers handle all aspects of the business from seed to sale. One of those growers is a family business with roots in law enforcement and in the military. From member station WLRN, Chris Remington has their story.
Stephen Garrison didn't plan on becoming a marijuana grower.
I've made plenty of marijuana arrests in my 20 years in law enforcement. It was a law and I enforced it.
Stephen worked for many years as a police officer until moving up to police chief in the small Miami community of Virginia Gardens. He retired more than 30 years ago. I met him at the Flowery, the medical marijuana treatment center he owns and operates with his son Donovan. He understands the contradiction that he used to arrest people for marijuana, and now he grows pot himself.
I think anybody that's in jail for that should be turned loose today.
The Garrisons would never have gotten into the medical marijuana business if it wasn't for their son and brother, Matt.
He was a disabled veteran, and he really believed in the medical advantages in the marijuana compared to all of the drugs they gave him.
In 2017, Matt died from an overdose on his sleep medication. It was ruled heart failure. He had served multiple tours of duty in Iraq. He was charged with finding improvised explosive devices and detonating them. And he came back with injuries, both emotional and physical. Matt was prescribed painkillers by the VA and Ambien for his sleep issues, but felt marijuana just worked better. His family noticed the adverse reaction the prescription drugs were having on him and recommended he try getting a medical marijuana card.
He said, well, I can't. I think it'll compromise my situation with the VA and I could lose my concealed carry permit.
Even though marijuana patients can have those permits. After Matt died, the family applied to become medical marijuana growers. That first application was denied. They sued the state of Florida, and 2 years later, their license was finally granted.
The production line, it's no different than making a belt.
Matt's brother Donovan is responsible for keeping the operation running smoothly.
If we don't water it, if it doesn't get light, we have a problem.
Rooms are divided by the different stages of the plant's life cycle, from seedling to full bloom. There are different light systems and water filtration depending on the variety of marijuana being grown. Major medical marijuana companies like Trulieve or Surterra are outselling the homestead business to the tune of millions of dollars. Florida law requires medical marijuana companies to handle all aspects of the operation, so the Flowery cannot outsource deliveries. And Donovan says that puts a big strain on their company.
Sometimes, and it kills me every time, but I go to Jackson for one order. Now, hopefully, I have a bunch of stuff in the middle that I can make sense of it, but there's a lot of days I lose $500 a day in labor and fuel and insurance and whatever just to get to my customer.
The Flowery is looking to expand their operations, building a new warehouse that could produce 10 times their current output. But Stephen Garrison always keeps in mind why the company started in the first place, his son Matt.
He was considered, certainly by me and by his fellow soldiers, as a hero.
Stephen is helping raise Matt's two children. He says he'll support his grandkids, whether they choose a career in the military or want to stay working on the farm. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Remington in Homestead, Florida.
When the pandemic hit, most of us who work in offices were suddenly hit with the prospect of working from home for a year and a half. But people with disabilities have been asking for flexible work options for years, a request rejected in most cases. Alan Yu of WHYY's The Pulse looked into whether this could now change.
When writer Elsa Hunnison graduated from college in 2008, she started looking for a long-term job. During the interview process, she realized she would have a problem.
And then I asked, well, what kind of work environment is it? And I've been told by some companies that they would have hired me, but I couldn't work in an open office, and that was against their culture. Like, they couldn't give me an office to work from.
Hunnison is deafblind. She carries a white cane, and she wears high-index lenses and bilateral hearing aids. She says an open office layout, which has become very popular with companies, just does not work for her.
I need to be set up in a spot where I have enough light. I need to be set up in a spot where my blind eye isn't in a place where people can constantly come up on that side, because it's really unsettling to have people constantly sort of in my space when I can't see them.
The hearing aids amplify sound. You can imagine what this means in an open office.
Hearing aids pick up every single noise in a room that you're in. So the sound of 30 people clicking on keyboards or the sound of a bunch of people getting up for lunch can be really overwhelming.
She can learn to filter out that noise, but that is work she has to do on top of work. She tried to explain this to prospective employers.
And the response was basically no, like that would harm our office culture by treating you differently, is more or less what I was told.
Other people I spoke to echoed this kind of experience. Mason Ameri, an associate professor at Rutgers Business School, says employers are reluctant to accommodate these requests because they do not understand how to work with people with disabilities or are prejudiced against them.
And oftentimes employers perceive workers with disabilities as just straight up less productive and costlier due to accommodations.
In a 2015 experiment, he and his colleagues sent out identical resumes for accountant positions. The only difference being that some resumes mentioned people having a disability and some did not. Companies were 26% less likely to be interested in job applications that mentioned disabilities. And the researchers chose disabilities that would not impact the work of an accountant to isolate the effects of bias. The pandemic forced many employers of office workers to let them work from home in March 2020. That infuriates Elsa Hunnison.
I'm angry that it took this. It took a literal global pandemic for society to say, okay, you can work from home so that we don't all get sick. But disabled people, and there are disabled people I know, who have literally been cut out of the workforce because they cannot leave their homes because they will get sick.
And other advocates say the pandemic proved that policies against flexible work are not based on evidence, just opinion. Recent research from the legal sector in the UK found that remote work is the most requested but most refused accommodation for people who are disabled. So is remote work now here to stay? There have been a few lawsuits in the past where workers with disabilities try to ask for remote work options under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Judges usually have ruled in favor of employers not having to allow flexible work. But Cheryl Bates-Harris says people who are able-bodied should not think of people who are disabled as a different category of the population. She is a senior disability advocacy specialist at the National Disability Rights Network. She's been handling these work-related issues for years.
We are all just a slip and fall away from a disability.
She got into this line of work because of what she went through in the 1980s when she was a driver's license examiner.
I had a head-on collision on a motorcycle when I was 27, and that really damaged my legs. When I had my accident, I was in the hospital for 3 months, and then it took another 18, 19 months before I was recovered enough to be able to think about employment, and I lost my job. I mean, they said, you're welcome to come back and reapply when you're able.
She says she never got the choice to work from a desk or talk about how she could do her work while recovering.
And I felt that was so unfair because I was not suddenly incompetent. I was injured. I was hurt. Clearly, it took time for bones to heal and whatever.
She says the pandemic made it clear that people can work from home with the proper equipment. So she hopes companies will no longer deny people with disabilities when they ask for that accommodation. For Here and Now, I'm Alan Yu.
We are all just a slip and a fall away from a disability. What a great reminder. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.